good morning and welcome to Perspectives. Today, we're talking all things gardening, from attracting beneficial insects to keeping pests out of your vegetable patch and everything in between. We have a panel of experts here ready to answer your questions on sustainable landscaping, using native plants, composting, organic gardening practices, and more. Joining us in the studio are Courtney Schoen, TAP coordinator for the City of Tallahassee, Molly Jameson, Sustainable Agriculture and Community Food Systems Extension Agent for UF IFAS in Leon County, Mark Tansik, Horticulture Extension Agent for UF IFAS in Leon County, Lily Anderson-Messick, General Manager for Native Nurseries, and Jeremy Greer, Lead Farmer at Orchard Pond Organics. And remember, you can join the conversation by giving us a call at 414-1234. If you're outside the Tallahassee area, give us a call at 1-800-926-8809 or send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org. So good morning, everyone. Welcome for thank you for joining us today.
Good morning.
I think maybe a great way to start here is just to go around the table quickly, let you all introduce yourselves and kind of let us know what your areas of expertise are. So Jeremy, I'll start with you.
Okay. My name is Jeremy Greer. I'm from Orchard Pond Organics. I'm the lead farmer. I pretty much spend most of my day moving stuff around, getting food to people's plates.
All right. Great. And Courtney, what about you?
I'm Courtney Schoen. I work for the City of Tallahassee's Stormwater Management Department, and I run the TAP program, which is Think About Personal Pollution. We provide education about reducing stormwater runoff and how you can landscape in a water-friendly way.
Okay, great. And Molly, what about you?
UF IFAS Extension, Leon County, and just teach the community all about vegetable gardening, compost, taking care of your food waste, pest management, everything in the garden.
All right. And Mark, how about you?
I am the horticulture agent at the UF IFAS Extension in Leon County, and I deal with mostly lawn and landscape issues. So what's wrong with your turf? What's wrong with your shrubs? What kind of pests do you have in your yard or your house sometimes? And I work with Molly also on composting and issues like that.
All right. And Lily, how about you?
I'm the general manager of Native Nurseries here in Tallahassee. We're a native plant nursery. We also have a wild bird store and a nature gift shop. But I talk to people about why native plants are so important and how to incorporate them in their yard.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much all for being here today. I want to start by talking a little bit about, I talked in the intro about how the days are getting warmer, the birds are chirping, the flowers are blooming, people are starting to go outside. But I know that the Tallahassee's growing season has already been underway for a little while here. And so for people who are maybe a little behind, maybe just now starting to think about gardening, is it too late? Molly, maybe I'll start with you. Can somebody start a garden this weekend?
Oh, sure, but not tomatoes. I think you're a little bit too late for tomatoes. And really, all winter is a great gardening time. Yeah. We take August off.
Yeah.
That's when it's not time to garden. But yeah, okra, squash, all your real hot-loving watermelon, everything that loves the heat, you can still start now. And but tomatoes, you probably should have started back in February.
Mm-hmm. And Lily, how about from your perspective, if somebody wants to start gardening, maybe they're not going to start a vegetable garden, maybe they want to start growing some beautiful flowers.
Well, the great thing about Tallahassee is we're just in a climate zone that you can garden year-round mm-hmm. here. You know, even in August, there are things to do in the yard. You can still plant if you're willing to be committed to watering constantly. In general, the best time to plant trees and shrubs is in the fall and winter, when they're dormant and not in active growth. But annuals, perennials, native wildflowers, you can plant those in spring, summer, and fall. The only thing to take into consideration is as it gets hotter, you have to water a lot more mm-hmm. because the water evaporates quickly and newly planted plants need a lot of water to establish a root system.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, you guys have community garden plots there at Orchard Pond that people can use. Do you have people who are coming in even now who are interested in starting a garden in community garden spaces?
Yeah, this is the main time that people come out this time of year, and then fall. Generally, during the heat of the summer, they take a break and
vacation.
They go away and they come back. But yeah, they come out. The community plotters, I see them in the morning and in the evening, just hanging out in the garden.
Mm-hmm. And Courtney, I believe the city has some community garden spaces available also for people to use.
Exactly. That's a really great program that we're excited about. When people are in a neighborhood where maybe they don't have large enough yards or not a great enough space to grow vegetables, they can look around and identify a city-owned plot that might be vacant, and we'll help people with this whole process. They can apply to use a vacant plot. They can get together with their neighbors, and we'll run a water line out there so they have access
to
water.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's something that we're pretty proud of, you know, if it works out in the community. So,
very cool. Neat. And so, Molly, if somebody wanted, was listening right now and they said, hey, they say it's not too late, I can get started today. If somebody wanted to start a garden, what are the first steps they should be considering?
The first steps is do your YMCA, as Mark just did. So sunlight. So make sure you have an area for vegetable gardening anyway, yeah, that has 6 hours of sun. You know, as we get into the real heat of the summer, sometimes some dappled shade is okay. But make sure you have sun, you have a water source, you know, a place where you're going to be willing to bring water over the time that it gets hot. And then you want to have soil. So you might have semi-decent soil, or you might want to bring in some, maybe make a raised bed, get some compost. So site selection, just being sunlight and water and having good soil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, soil is something that when I read about gardening, talk about gardening a lot, I'm constantly hearing people talk about the importance of making sure you have good, healthy soil. But, you know, I wasn't in the FFA growing up. I didn't do the soil judging competitions, and I don't really know how to tell what's in my soil. Mark, is that something the Extension Office can help me with?
Oh, yes. Perfect question. Yes. So at the Extension Office, we provide soil test kits. So you can come to our office if you're not sure the health of your soil, and we can give you a pretty good idea, and then we can give you tips on how to improve it. So Molly and I work a lot with composting, so a really great way to improve the health of your soil is to just add compost, compost, compost.
Compost, compost,
yeah.
Compost.
Yeah. The key to improving the health of any soil is always organic matter, which is typically lacking from the average yard, because we're not letting leaves and other organic matter naturally decompose into our yards and lawns. So adding that organic matter back with mushroom compost or your home compost is what makes hard-packed clay soils or very sandy soils good soils to grow plants in.
It's like magic.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know there are things like mushroom compost, like you mentioned, which I can just buy in a big bag from the store, or I can make my own compost.
Yeah. Molly and I can teach you how to make your own compost.
Yeah, what if I wanted to get started with composting? I think for some people, they think maybe there's a big startup cost. You got to get that big drum that you turn.
Compost happens.
Yeah.
Naturally.
It's just a pile of rotting materials.
So, the microbes are there. Yeah.
If you get the right mix of materials, and you can, you know, call Molly and I and we'll help you figure that out. But if you get the right mix of ingredients, it just happens. You don't need a fancy bin or tumbler. Pile will work.
If you want it to happen really quickly, you do extra work.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you could just put stuff in a pile in your yard, in a certain spot in your yard, and it becomes soil.
Yeah, make a lasagna. So you just take your leaves, your carbon, and then you have like your nitrogen, so like food waste. You mix that together like making a lasagna, and then the microbes do the rest.
Yeah, another great thing to add is, especially this time of year when the grass is growing really quickly, you want to add your grass clippings. And one of the things we really like to address is the issue of grass clippings as stormwater pollution. You definitely want to keep those don't blow them into the street or your driveway.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Definitely rake that stuff up and
you can
put it in
those
your compost.
Getting blown into the street all the time.
Right, exactly. It's just not often on people's minds, but people are mowing every week right now, and the grass clippings are really going to add up, and you want to keep that nitrogen in your yard and not in our water.
And if you don't have a lot of grass clippings or leaves, your neighbors sometimes will just bag it for you and put it on their curb. So pay attention to what your neighbors have.
Yeah. And of course, compost also, you put your kitchen scraps in there as long as they're certain kinds of kitchen scraps, like vegetable scraps, fruit scraps, no meats and cheeses. What are the other rules? What do I keep out of my compost?
Animal products for fats and oils.
Yeah. Pretty much. So no meat, no cheeses, not Fido's leftovers. Oh, yeah. So no meat eating animal waste, and that's mostly it. So it's not that those things don't decompose, but it's just a different type of bacteria that's breaking that stuff down, and you don't want to bring in raccoons and other rats. Types
that's,
of critters.
That's the main thing, is bringing in the critters, because we actually make our compost out of fish waste from Southern Seafood and chips. It's our friend
Fish and Chips.
Yeah. Farmer Herman's Fish and Chips.
Yeah. So, and but your neighbors wouldn't appreciate if you were doing that in your yard.
We have a lot of vultures that hang around.
Yeah.
But they do their work too. But as long as we turn it often and keep it covered with the wood chips, we generally don't have a problem or smell. Mm-hmm. That's what we have to turn it, you know, probably every 3 days. And that keeps it breaking down really fast and gets rid of the smell. So
yeah, and so the turning is important because it helps to build the heat within the composting system.
Right, you want it between 130 degrees and 160 degrees. And for our organic certification, we have to keep it between that temperature and turn it 5 times within 15 days at that temperature to make it organic certified.
Okay.
Interesting.
What if somebody, they just don't feel like they have space in their yard for composting, but they want access to compost? I guess they said we can buy it at the store. There used to be, I know, groups within the community that offered compost. They'd bring compost to your house, or they'd pick up your supplies for compost.
There's Community Compost is a program run by Sundiata, and that is a program. I think if you just look up Community Compost, you'll find him, and he offers a service where he comes by your house, he takes your, you know, food scraps, and he leaves you with some finished compost to garden with. So if you don't want to do it on your own property, Sundiata can help you out.
All right.
You could also use worms.
Great. Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking all things gardening here on Perspectives Today, and we'll be back with more information on that. Welcome back to Perspectives Today. We're talking all things gardening on our show. And remember, you can give us a call and ask our expert panel of gardening experts any of your questions that you might have about what's going on in your lawn, a garden project that you're excited to start. Give us a call. That number is 414-1234, or you can call us at 1-800-926-8809 if you're outside the Tallahassee area. You can also send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org. So before the break, we were talking a lot about if you wanted to get started gardening, and we were really focusing on vegetable gardening, because I think for a lot of people, that's an exciting way to get started. It's very exciting to grow your own food. But if you want to be a successful vegetable gardener, you pointed out, Molly, you need a lot of sunlight. But what about for people who maybe they don't have a lot of sunlight? Lily, what would you suggest that maybe somebody who has a shadier area or maybe has a woodland garden, what kinds of things could they be doing?
Well, there are a lot of native wildflowers that we call woodland wildflowers that grow in the shade. One of them that's blooming right now is a really stunning native, easy to grow perennial called Indian Pink. And unlike its name, it's not pink. It's red, and a red tubular flower that opens up yellow with a yellow center. And it's really gorgeous. Every time people come into the nursery and they see them in bloom, they walk up and say, "Can I ask you what this red plant is over here?" And it's funny to me because I would think that they would be in every yard. They're a really easy to grow plant. And since they grow in full shade, it's a plant for people who have a lot of oaks in their yard.
Okay. And so, you know, you were mentioning that those are native wildflowers, and I think that's a whole discussion that would be great to get into. You at Native Nurseries really encourage people to use native plants. Why? Mm-hmm. Why would someone want to plant a native plant?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. The reason is because we like to have birds and butterflies and clean air and clean water and other services that a healthy functioning ecosystem provides, and native plants are the basis of that ecosystem. Without native plants, all of the insects that are the basis of the food web for all of our wildlife wouldn't be here, because non-native plants haven't evolved with our native insects, and they don't have the relationships that have built over time that allow them to eat the non-native plants. So when you plant native, you end up with holes in your leaves sometimes, and that's great because you also end up with baby birds in your yard and other wildlife that depend on those insects that are eating the leaves.
Yeah, the way I've heard it described to me, which I just think is very fascinating, is it's not that even necessarily that our native insects are picky and that they don't like native plants, but their like mouths aren't shaped the right way and they literally cannot eat.
Well, most of it is chemistry. It's that the native insects have evolved to and adapted to the chemistry in the leaves of our native plants. And they've developed that relationship over millennia. So it's not something that happens over 200 years. So you might have an oak that is, you know, in the same genus from Florida and one that is in the same genus but from, you know, Japan, and our native moths or butterfly species that can eat our native oak, their caterpillars can't eat the non-native.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I know we were talking yesterday a little bit about native species, and as Lily was saying, the importance that native species have in supporting a healthy ecosystem. And you gave me that great example of a study on chickadees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a recent report came out that basically had researchers working with citizens in their backyards. And so these citizen scientists were, you know, monitoring these chickadee nests, and what they found was the yards that had 70% or more native plants making up the landscape, you know, they successfully bred many more chicks than the yards that had less than 70%. So some birds, you know, just skipped reproduction altogether. But again, when you had all these native plants, they
and had especially many more chicks. Trees, yeah. And especially the oaks and pines in our communities are incredibly important. The mature oaks and pines. And so when people decide to take out a tree in their yard, that has a large effect on the wildlife in the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these trees support a whole host of species that we're not often thinking about them. They're small little things, but the service they provide, like Lily said, they're the basis of the food chain for everything larger above them.
So oaks, for example, support 551 species of Lepidoptera, which are butterflies and moths. And so you don't even think about oaks being covered in caterpillars, but they are. You hardly even see the damage. And those caterpillars are vitally important, especially to our baby birds. 96% of birds species don't feed their babies seeds or berries. Their babies only eat insects. And so to support a nesting pair of chickadees or bluebirds, on average per day, the adults will bring back to the nest 500 to 600 caterpillars.
I've been watching a pair of chickadees in my backyard do it. It's pretty amazing.
And all of this research was done by an entomologist in Delaware called, his name is Doug Tallamy, and he has an excellent book called Bringing Nature Home, all about the co-evolution of insects and native plants and why they're so codependent.
Mm-hmm. Courtney, I know that native trees is something that the city has been focusing on a lot. I've talked with different city officials before about the importance of getting a good variety of native species. Often native trees tend to hold up better during hurricanes, for example. We wouldn't see quite as many downed trees, not as much power outage. And through the Adopt a Tree program, I think the city is trying to increase the number of native tree plantings throughout the city.
Right, that's right. We are looking a little bit more at maybe not so much the ornamental value, but are they going to really be beneficial for the ecosystem and for our urban canopy? That program does run in the fall and winter, and so it's kind of closed out for the year now, but we'll look for it again starting in about November. People will be able to see the varieties, and I'm not sure what they're going to choose this year, but they're probably in that process now, so
basically you just sort of fill out a form and the city foresters can come out and evaluate your property and see if what species will do the best on your property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they give you the tree. Your only obligation is to promise to water.
Right, exactly.
They plant
mm-hmm. it for you, and they just want you to keep it alive. But yeah, it's a great program and a good way to help protect our urban canopy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the city and the county both do the tree adopt a tree programs, and they've done a really good job at having a real diversity of native plants, mm-hmm. native trees to offer for that program.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Something, Courtney, I know you also focus on is rain gardens. I don't know a lot about rain gardens. I'm assuming they focus a lot on using native plants.
Exactly. When Lily was talking about the benefits that native plants have for our wildlife, I was thinking about, you know, they also just provide a great service for our water. So TAP, we talk a lot to people about landscaping in ways that can help manage their water. Native plants can do a lot more. They can provide a lot more benefits for the water than just a regular sod lawn. Your sod lawn won't be able to absorb as much water. So when it's raining and that water is running off, it just creates a sheet flow and can end up in the street, and it carries pollutants. When you plant native grasses, for example, their root systems are so much longer that they really will draw the water down. And when you landscape in these ways, you can really reduce your runoff.
And clean the water.
Right. They help filter. They can slow down pollutants, and they help absorb nutrients and really draw things down into the soil where they're broken down by microbes and other bacteria in the soil. It's a really, really
neat
process.
It's a natural filtration system.
Exactly, a natural filtration. So you can just sort of – you don't have to do a rain garden, a specific rain garden. You can kind of use some berms and swales and – use mulch and more native plants. But if you want to focus on a project like a rain garden, that's really just creating a little depression, sort of a natural wetland in your property that allows the water to have a place to settle. It'll slow down, it'll soak into the water, into the soil, and then it'll really kind of create a habitat for more of these native plants.
Yeah, we worked with Courtney to put in a rain garden at the extension office, and it works really well.
Working?
Captures all this water that was running off the driveway and the sidewalk, and instead of running off down the drive, it goes into the rain garden. And so that water gets captured and slowly goes into the soil and cleans the water. And now there's also frogs and all sorts of other critters that are hanging out in the rain garden. So it's pretty, too.
It is pretty. It's great. You can really reduce that erosion, too. Before, I think you were seeing a lot of sediment washing mm-hmm. down the driveway and down into the street every time it rained. And now that's all being held in place.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of yard or what kind of, I guess, property is a good place to install a rain garden? Like, I live in a small townhouse. Should I be putting a rain garden there? Or is there some way that I can participate in that kind of work?
Yeah, I've just worked with some residents in a group of townhomes who are, they're going to work together and actually do some rain gardens sort of in tandem, which is going to be really great. A lot of homes in Tallahassee are really great candidates because we do really, really have a lot of, there's a lot of slopes, lot of sloping.
The water runs
off, and it just runs off so quickly. So if you can do anything to sort of modify that and slow the water down a little bit and keep it on your property, you're gonna benefit the soil, you're gonna benefit the water, and it looks beautiful too.
And more wildlife.
Right, exactly, more wildlife.
And so. I understand, like, one of the reasons that rain gardens are important and what this subject is important is because it's helping to stop that runoff like you were talking about, and a lot of that runoff might be carrying things we don't like fertilizer. People still love their lovely green lawns, but to keep those going, a lot of times it requires a lot of...
They think it does.
Yes, exactly. They think it requires a lot of fertilizer. And so that's a perfect segue into where I was going. What are ways maybe that people who want to have those pretty green lawns but want to be conscious about their fertilizer use, what are things they can be doing, Mark?
They should look up Florida Friendly Landscaping Program through the University of Florida Extension Office. And there's a lot of tips in there. There's these 9 principles that if homeowners follow those principles, they'll be doing a great job at reducing non-point source pollution.
Mark will be teaching a workshop all about those principles at Native Nurseries coming up soon.
So, you know, I go around and I talk to a lot of homeowners. We do workshops and I also train commercial landscapers on how to properly you know, calculate how much fertilizer you should be putting out. Because honestly, many of the commercial guys, I think, are doing a pretty good job. But homeowners can go out and buy, you know, as much fertilizer as they want and put it out on their lawns. So the main thing I tell them is to make sure you're putting it out correctly so that you reduce the chance of non-point source pollution or these pollutants get into the lakes and streams in our area.
And get a soil test to figure out if your soil actually needs to have these nutrients. Then you'll know exactly how much to actually apply.
Yeah, if you put it out correctly, the grass will absorb most of those nutrients. But if it's when you put too much or at the wrong time, it runs off. You know, too much fertilizer. Also, you know, for folks that are trying to get that perfect green yard, you know, it can sometimes harm and damage, you know, the turf. So you want to do it just right. And we can help you out. So
one of the biggest things I think that causes unhealthy lawns is cutting the lawn too short. If you don't leave enough green blade on your sod, the plants are not able to take up the nutrients from the sun in order to have a healthy root system. And so it encourages like a decline in your yard. If you set your lawnmower to have the highest available blade cutting, I guess, and just cut more often, then your yard is going to be a lot healthier. A lot of lawns don't even need fertilizer. But if you're going to use fertilizer, one of the key things is using a water-insoluble fertilizer so that it doesn't automatically, you know, wash away. So that it breaks down slowly over time.
Yeah, you want to look for a slow release fertilizer product.
And also only fertilizing during the peak growing season is key as well.
Because it's not going to use it.
Right. Putting fertilizer down in the winter isn't going to help your green grass get greener.
It just won't take it up.
Yeah.
What about, I think a lot of people think that if they use organic fertilizer, though, then it's safe. They're good to go. What about that?
So organic fertilizers are slow release, you know, just by their nature.
Naturally.
But, I mean, still, even with organic fertilizers, you could overdo it. So that's why it's always important, and I tell everyone this, you read the label, right?
Yeah.
You read the label of the product you buy, and you put out the right amount according to the label. And if you follow that rule, then you will probably be okay.
Right. More fertilizer is not necessarily better for your lawn.
And the reason we should care is because that fertilizer is nitrogen, which is running into our waterways and then causing
and
some of what we're seeing, like at Wakulla Springs, for example, right?
Yeah, I mean, the nitrogen in Wakulla Springs, I think they've, you know, more connected to septic tank issues, but the fertilizers don't help. But when you see some of our local lakes, Lake Munson is one that I think of.
Excessive algae growth.
You know, these algal blooms, or even small
which
ponds
can clog,
in neighborhoods.
Clog up the waterways even.
You know, when they turn green, people don't usually like that. And it's not good for the wildlife in the pond or the lake. So if we can reduce that, you know, that's a good thing.
It's also just a waste of money, and chemical fertilizers are petroleum products, which are an unsustainable resource.
Something else I hear people talk a lot when they talk about lawn care is overwatering. And I think that's less of a concern in our area, or it gets less attention in our area.
Well, I was going to follow up with Lily. The main problems I see with folks' lawns in Tallahassee is they're cut too short or they're overwatered. Again, Florida Friendly Landscaping Program, if you go look that up or if you come talk to us at the Extension office, we can get you all sorts of resources, information on how to calibrate your irrigation system, make sure you're putting out the right amount.
The right time of day.
The right time of day to make sure that your lawn is as healthy as can be.
Okay. So on the flip side of fertilizer, the other thing to talk about is pest control. We talked a little bit about how you can use organic fertilizer. Maybe that's a little bit of a better method for growing your lawn or your garden. I want to talk about organic pest control methods. And Jeremy, I want to go to you.
Okay.
I know you guys use a lot of organic farming practices there at Orchard Pond. What if I have a small garden at my house and I've got some pests I want to keep out, what are some go-to practices that you might recommend?
Having space for the beneficial insects. In our garden, it's about 95% of the pests or the insects are beneficial and 5% are actual pests. So instead of just getting rid of all the bugs and then you get the super bug that comes in and eats all your tomatoes, you make sure to keep as much pet or beneficial insects as possible. We have spiders, dragonflies, wasps, and we generally don't have a problem at, out at the farm.
Yeah, going back to diversity in the food web.
Yeah.
The main thing is knowing what you're treating. Yes. So if you don't know what pest you're treating, you can't use a specific pesticide. And if you can't use a specific pesticide, you're using a broad spectrum, which just kills everything.
Everything.
All of the beneficial insects as well. And then, like he says, when you kill all the beneficials, you end up getting the bad ones back, and then they have nothing keeping them in check.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we have a problem with Colorado potato beetles. But what I do is I go and I shake the potato bush, and they fall on the ground, and that's it.
Yeah.
And something comes and eats them, and that's the end of it.
And having a level of tolerance.
Yeah, so like, exactly. You know. When it's at this point, they're coming in and they're eating the tops. Well, we're about to harvest the potatoes anyway.
So it doesn't matter.
Why?
Yeah, just because you see bugs in your yard or your garden doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. So, you know, like Lily said, know what is actually attacking your plants and then focus on how do you control that particular pest.
And following good, you know, like cultural practices should be your first method of defense.
Preventing.
Yes, exactly. It's like, so do crop rotation and know what varieties you're growing. And so if you have a nice setup, then you're less likely to have issues.
All right. And if any of our listeners out there have a question for our experts here, give us a call. 414-1234 is that number. We'll take a quick break and then be back to your calls. Welcome back to Perspectives. Today we're talking about all things gardening, and we've got a great panel of gardening experts here today, and they're ready to take your calls. If you have any questions about your garden, how to get started, or what's going on in your garden today, you can give us a call at 414-1234. If you're outside the Tallahassee area, give us a call at 1-800-926-8809. And we do have some callers who are calling in now, so we'll go ahead and go to line one, where we have Brian ready to ask us a question. Brian, welcome to Perspectives.
Hey, what's going on, y'all?
Hey there.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good. Hey, first of all, I got a question, but I also want to give a shout out to Jeremy. I went to high school.
Go, Jeremy.
I'm out here. I'm actually doing some lawn care stuff, and I always listen to y'all on the radio. So, yeah.
Nice.
Great.
What's your question, Brian?
Avocados.
Avocados.
Yeah, I hear they take like 100 years to grow an avocado tree. Is that true?
It takes a long time, and it also takes a frost-free area, which we don't have.
Yeah, I think avocados, it would be a little bit out of the zone here in Tallahassee, but I do know that Just Fruits and Exotics down on 98 has an avocado tree that produces, but they have it in just the right little microclimate, so it stays a little bit warmer there. And they've had it there for a long time. So you can see some close by, but it'd be something pretty tricky to pull off.
Yeah. The other issue with avocados in the state of Florida now is the
ambrosia beetle.
The ambrosia beetle, which brings the laurel wilt, and it's attacking the South Florida orchards of avocados. And we definitely already have that here. It's killing the red bays in this area. And so it can also kill avocados. And I actually had a customer come in recently who had photos of her avocado tree that was a few years old, but had suddenly started dying very quickly. And I could look at it and see right away that it was bay laurel wilt.
Yeah, a lot of people.
Ambrosia beetle.
A lot of people do start avocados because if you throw it in your compost pile, you'll notice it sprout, and it usually will last until we get a good
avocados cold snap. Happen.
I've got one growing in where I used to throw my compost. Yeah. It's been there for a few years.
That's
so
how I started gardening.
Really? I thought I'd see what happens.
Yeah, you know, it's going to take quite a while to get some
fruit.
Right, not 100 years, but
we haven't
quite
had
a while.
An incredibly cold freeze since that time. And it is, it's near a fence, so it might get a little bit of protection that way. But Mark, you mentioned zones, and I think that's an important thing to talk about when people are looking at what they might want to plant, it's important to consider what will grow in this zone if they want to be successful. What is our zone?
So we're zone 8B, and I've heard a lot of people talking about, are they going to change the zones because of, you know, climate change? And, you know, we're still in 8B. Mm-hmm. So I will, you know, I'd recommend if you're looking at plants, most of the time when you're looking up information on plants for your garden, they will tell you what zone it's zoned for. So just keep following those recommendations.
The zones don't take into consideration, though, is humidity. And mm-hmm. so sometimes you'll see someone might find a plant online and it says, well, it will grow in zone 8B. But it will grow in that zone in California, but not here in Tallahassee because it's too wet.
So interesting.
Something to consider.
Great. Well, it looks like we've got a lot of calls coming in, so let's just keep going to our calls here. We'll move on to line 2. We've got Joe on the line, and it looks like he's got a question for us about crepe myrtles. Joe, hello, and welcome to Perspectives.
Hey, how are you? I consider myself a landscape gardener. And I understand crepe myrtles are imported from Spain. I'm not sure that's correct, but that's what I think. There's a bunch of crepe myrtles planted around Lake Ella. Can the city replace those around Lake Ella and some of the boulevards with some kind of native plants?
All right.
What a great idea.
Well, they could, that'd be an investment by the city. But there's definitely lots of alternatives to crepe myrtles.
Yeah, crepe myrtles aren't a terrible plant. I don't have anything against them. They are great for some pollinators. And that bark is really beautiful when they become mature and when they're pruned correctly. But I do agree. I think that, that area, that space could be better used for habitat if we planted natives.
Mm-hmm. And what if maybe I'm a person who's doing a planting in my yard and I've been admiring my neighbor's crepe myrtle and I want something that's maybe equally beautiful but is native? What would be something for me to consider?
So we would consider crepe myrtles a small tree. And some of the small trees for full sun, which is also the same situation that crepe myrtles like, would be fringe tree. It's also known as granddaddy graybeard.
Beautiful tree.
It's a really beautiful native tree in the olive family. And it has fringy clouds of white blooms in spring. Some other trees would be red buds. Our native red bud is one of my favorite trees. It is deciduous. It has heart-shaped leaves and blooms right out of the bare branches in early spring with these bright pink fuchsia flowers.
And you can see both of those at the native park at the Governor's Mansion.
Oh, nice.
Yep. They have both the red bud and the fringe tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the extension office, too, we have a pretty extensive garden around our building, and we're having a big open house and plant sale on May 11th, so mm-hmm. there's a little
shout
out there. But at our garden around the building, you can also come by and walk around and see a lot of examples. Everything's labeled, and mm-hmm. we have fringe tree mm-hmm. and red bud there as well.
Halicia, the silver bell, is a really pretty native tree that is starting to be used more, and it blooms on bare branches in spring and has bell-shaped white blooms. There's some lovely mature ones at Lake Alberta that were blooming this spring that were really lovely.
And one more thing about crepe myrtles, they do not need to be hacked every year. We call that crepe murder. You do not need to do that.
They're much lovely when they are prettier, allowed to grow into a nice shape.
All right. Let's keep moving down our call list here. I'm excited that we've got some great callers coming in. We'll move on to line 3. We've got a call coming in from Marnie, who has a question about some specific plants, it sounds like. Marnie, hello, and welcome to Perspectives.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is about mosquito control, and I'm wondering if there are any natural remedies or plants that can go in our backyard, which are also safe for our dogs, that could help repel mosquitoes.
So, Lily, did you want
to... Yeah, I get this question a lot at the nursery, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news because I read, I see in so many magazines and online, people say, just plant lemongrass or plant a citronella plant or lavender. And maybe that works for Ohio mosquitoes, but our Asian tiger mosquitoes, those really bad mosquitoes, they're not going to be stopped, even if you rub yourself.
I mean, maybe if you were in a field of citronella plant and rolling in it, you would have mosquitoes stay away. Yeah. But the best thing for mosquitoes is just prevention.
Preventing so those standing water.
Yeah. And BTI. Yeah.
BTI is an organic or is a kind of a natural pesticide for mosquito larvae that if you do have, say, rain barrels or something, areas that hold
like
water.
I collect rainwater for my orchids and to prevent mosquitoes from, you know, reproducing in that water, I can use these little things called mosquito dunks or bits. And they have BT in it, Bacillus thuringiensis, which is a bacteria that kills just the larva of those mosquitoes.
And that water is safe for butterflies and frogs and lizards.
Safe
and
for everything else.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, I was going to ask along those same lines about bird baths because I think that is
lots of customers use that for bird baths as well.
Perfect. Yeah, mosquitoes can reproduce in something as small as a water cap. Yeah. So it doesn't take much.
Or magnolia leaf. I see water getting under in magnolia leaves.
The mosquitoes, they need about 7 days, 5 to 7 days in that water. So
I thought it was just three that they...
No, we recommend every 3 days going out and emptying your standing water. So if you can do that, that'll be much better at preventing mosquitoes than planting the citronella plant or lemongrass.
And you should be clearing out your bird bath too anyways to freshen the water.
For birds. Why are bird baths important? That's something that I've heard a lot about. If you are interested in helping your local critters and you're planting in native plants, then you might want to add a bird bath. Why? What's a bird bath do?
Well, water is a essential ingredient for birds as well. They need it, and they also use it to clean themselves. And so if you wanted to attract birds to your yard, adding a water feature, a bird bath, or putting even when I water my plants sometime and put a sprinkler out, when it's dry, all the birds flock over to use that water to take a little bath in. Having water in your yard is essential for wildlife also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wildlife
especially
food,
when we go through drought
and shelter. So if you can provide
food, water, shelter.
I was just watching the Blue Jays take bird baths yesterday. It's kind of fun to watch.
Great. We've got some more calls coming in, and I want to remind our listeners that if you have a question for our panel here, you can give us a call at 414-1234. We'll go back to our phone lines. We've got Susan on the line. Susan, hello, and welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, Susan.
Yep. Hi. Are you there, Susan?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Susan.
My question is about stink bugs. I garden in South Georgia, just over the Florida line, and they have just gotten to where they ruin everything. And I've almost given up on tomatoes because larger tomatoes take so long to ripen that they get to them very quickly. And
they ruin the fruit.
They ruin the green beans. There's not anything they want. My only solution so far in my garden, because I do garden organically, is I have put physical barrier of netting, like to deal with the cabbage moss. And so I'm trying that on my tomato plant this year because they're self-pollinating, I understand. So anyway, I just wondered if you had any thoughts about the dreaded stink bug.
Sure. Thank you, Susan.
I would say one of the best things to do is start the garden as early as you possibly can and try to beat the bugs. And also specifically with the tomatoes, try a smaller variety. They seem to do way better. We've kind of gotten away from trying to grow the big tomatoes. We're just doing medium size and grape and cherry tomatoes, and finding that really helps.
One of the things that I do for the stink bugs is I have them on my tomatoes as well is with the I try to catch the first generation of them out in my yard.
Scouting.
And so what I do with them, because if you squish them, it stinks, is I take a bowl of soapy water and go out in the morning, and one of their natural defense mechanisms is to just fall. And so I put the bowl underneath them when I see them and then knock them right into the bowl of soapy water. And if you get that first generation of them and prevent them from growing exponentially, you won't have as many problems. Another thing I've noticed is that if I let my lawn grow up at all around my vegetable garden bed, they hide out in the grass. And so keeping the area around my bed mowed has helped as well.
And maybe trap crops, growing like sunflowers along with your tomatoes. Mm-hmm. You got to make sure you actually have a sunflower that's able to take time to get established. Mm-hmm. But that can attract like leaf-footed bugs.
And what are trap crops?
Oh, right. So trap crops are just crops that basically lure some of the bad pests to them. And then, so like if a leaf-footed bug
prefers that plant,
a sunflower, they'll go to the sunflower where you can come and take your soapy water and pick them off and put them in the soapy water, and they'll leave your tomatoes theoretically alone.
We found stink bugs to love artichoke.
Huh.
So that's been a good trap crop in our experience.
Yeah, at the extension office, the veg heads, the master gardeners who maintain the vegetable garden, have successfully used sunflowers, and you will see stink bugs all over mm-hmm. the flower, and then you can just knock into the soapy water or treat those, however you want to deal with them.
But you do want to treat, pay attention to your sunflowers and pick them off.
You got to scout. You got to be out there hanging out in the garden.
The main thing is there's nothing you can use to kill stink bugs that isn't going to kill everything.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so trying to use a pesticide in order to control them ends up defeating the whole point of pest issues in your garden.
And in a small garden, not like maybe a giant farm, but it's amazing what you can control by just being diligent and being out there
with
out
your hand
in the garden
and picking them, turn over the leaves, look at where there's holes, just paying attention to the environment.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, you mentioned one good technique, though, is to get your garden started early so that maybe those tomatoes are more established by the time that the bugs come out. How early should a person start their garden? When I look at the back of my seed packet, it tells me not to put out my seedlings until after the first frost, or the last frost, and the last frost in Tallahassee can sometimes be fairly
March.
Late in the spring.
April, even.
Yeah. Right. Well, you started in a greenhouse. I know Farmer Herman, they start their tomatoes in January, mm-hmm. and they use a lot of frost protection once they actually put them into the ground, and it's a lot of work, but... Uh-huh. You have those tomatoes mm-hmm. early, and you're not dealing with the hot weather and all the pests that come out with that.
And you have to know with each crop how much cold tolerance they can manage.
Right.
You could start your tomatoes in February outside, but you couldn't do that with eggplant and peppers.
Right, or basil.
Right. Really depends on the crop. And then even like with tomatoes, pest pressure, but then also even just temperatures above 70 degrees at night is when it really starts to inhibit flower and fruit production of tomatoes. So if you're starting your tomatoes right now, you're really not going to have a good crop.
Mm-hmm. And to address your seed packet comment, a lot of those seed packets are very generic and for the whole nation. So contact Molly. She's got some great resources from the Red Hills Small Farm Alliance mm-hmm. and Full Earth Farm specifically.
They started the Red Hills Small Farm Alliance put together a whole what to plant when and exactly which varieties and in what form by direct planting or transplanting.
Mm-hmm. And it's specific
and
to
it's
our area.
And it's very specific to our area.
Yeah.
And they gave that calendar to us, and we added to it, and we give it away to our customers mm-hmm. as well. But I think they have it on their website.
Yeah, they do. It's great. Just slap it on your fridge. It's color-coded. Mm-hmm. It really tells you what to do with all the big general crops. And then we have, with Extension, we have the Florida Vegetable Gardening Guide as well that divides Florida into north, central, and south. And you can find a lot of information on that, and it's online.
And if you go to your local garden centers rather than your big box stores, they'll tend to have the right plants and the right
at
varieties
the right
at the
mm-hmm.
right time.
But that Red Hills online planting calendar, I still use
excellent.
It all the time. It's great.
Yeah, Katie and Louise spent a lot of time getting that together.
Mm-hmm. What about speaking along those lines? So maybe some tips for people who want to get started gardening. and are looking for these resources. What do you guys think are the best resources available to somebody, or maybe, you know, somebody who's been gardening, they want to learn more, or somebody who wants to start gardening? What resources do you recommend?
Well, I'm biased, but I would say the Extension Office.
Yeah.
Definitely. Drive by 615 Paul Russell Road. Come say hi.
And also go and volunteer at a farm.
Right. Yeah. You can go to the farmer's market and talk to the farmers there and see what they have.
The varieties that they plant are varieties that grow well here.
Right. So we have the Saturday Market Square market from 8 to 1, and then there's also Bannerman Crossing on Wednesdays from 3 to 7.
Mm-hmm. And your local garden centers.
Of course.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us here today on Perspectives. I appreciate all of your input. It's been a great discussion. And I hope to see all of you again soon. Perspectives is produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee with technical assistance provided by Evan Rossi. Lydell Rawls is on the phones. I'm Regan McCarthy. Thank you.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.